Again, my name is Snehal Shah. I work for the Boston Public Health Commission. I'm the Director of Research and Evaluation there. And part of my role is I spend a lot of time sort of looking at public health surveillance data. And one of the things that I feel like is our primary responsibility as a health department is to disseminate that data to the public and figure out ways of disseminating the data and educating the public about health outcomes and health in their communities. And so I'm going to speak to that today. The overall I want to say that I have, I'm disclosing that I have no industry ties or anything to, I was supposed to put that on slide, but I forgot though. All right, so the objectives of the talk today are to describe the responsibility of local public health agencies to educate the public about disease prevention, describe past and present strategies used to communicate with community residents, including the use of epidemiologic data, and describe the evolution of the content of community public health education to include social determinants of health. So in general, when we think, you know, at this local public health level, when we think about educating the community, the goal is really in this education is to optimize the health status of our residents. Education raises awareness about disease prevention and emergency preparedness. It also may be used to increase awareness about public health programming. The education of our residents enhances their capacity to advocate for policy systems and environmental changes that can positively impact health, and they become partners in our work as we try to improve the health environment in our city. I think we honestly believe that the impact of a local public health agency is significantly limited if it does not engage residents through education and communication. We feel that local public health agencies are uniquely positioned to play a significant role in this education, primarily because we're interacting with residents on a regular basis. We're interacting with them through our, you know, day-to-day programming. We deliver a lot of services. We interact with community-based organizations and coalitions on a regular basis. We're interacting with hospitals, universities, all sorts of different settings in our community. And it puts us in this position to be able to talk about what we know about health outcomes and the differences in health outcomes across our city. I'm going to spend a few slides just talking about a little bit of the history of public health and public health practice in the city of Boston. I'll be honest, I had sort of two main sources for this information, so if anybody's interested, there was a fantastic book by John Blake about the history of public health in the town of Boston. And there was also several archival documents available through the Harvard University online library. And so if anybody's interested, I'm happy to share that information later on. It's also on the slides. So if we start in the 17th century, Boston sort of has a long history of public health practice. In New England, the New England colonies, and especially the Massachusetts Bay Colony, were among the first to focus on public responsibility as a means to prevent disease. In the 17th century, public education was actually very much focused on religious beliefs. You know, we didn't at the time have a lot of medical knowledge. We didn't understand what was causing disease, and it was thought that the presence of God and immoral behavior was actually leading to the occurrence of disease. There's a quote that I saw in many different things that I read that was, it said, disease was seen as God's chastisement for sin. And this is really a focus on individual behavior and the impact of immoral behavior. And that was what was communicated to the general public, that it's because of our behaviors that we are being, these diseases are visiting us. And even with this focus on individual behavior and religion, the local legislature, which is actually sort of, it was called the General Court, they did actually, what they did was they proclaimed these days of fasting, prayer, and humiliation to ward off disease. So this is how they were educating the public. They would hold these day-long and multiple day-long fasts and prayers to inform the public that it's your behavior that's leading to these diseases. And it was a way of educating people about immoral behavior and its relationship with disease. They didn't just focus on these religious, religious beliefs. They did also have some sense that it was their environment somehow contributing to ill health. And they didn't, you know, obviously know exactly how these things were connected, but you can see in the 17th century, there are a lot of actually regulations passed by the local government about the placement of privies, and privies are outhouses, and the pollution of water wells. And they clearly understood that these things were connected to disease, but they just didn't know how. And so there's this sort of mix of addressing religious beliefs, educating folks about their actions connected to religious beliefs, as well as educating them about environmental factors that might be leading to disease. So in the 18th and 19th century, there was some increased medical knowledge and less reliance on religious explanations. In 1799, the nation's first Board of Health was established here in Boston, and Paul Revere was actually its first health officer. In the late 18th century, repeated smallpox and yellow fever epidemics raised concern about the protection of health, and it was the reason this sort of concerns about protecting health led to several citizens demanding the presence of some sort of board with regulatory authority to make changes in the environment to protect health that led to the establishment of this first Board of Health. I want to sort of give two examples of community education, sort of one prior to the establishment of the Board of Health and one post the establishment. So the first one I'm going to talk about is the smallpox epidemic in 1721. You know, in looking at a lot of the existing information about the past, much of the way that public was educated at the time was through community meetings, bringing people together to talk about things, and printed text. And so what you have here is actually an example of two pamphlets that were produced as part of what has sort of been dubbed this smallpox pamphlet wars. And essentially what happened was that there were competing views about the value of inoculation. At this time, there was a group led by a reverend named Cotton Mather. Some of you may be familiar with him. He was actually a proponent of inoculation, and he was actually doing it he was working with one physician in Boston who agreed to do it with him, Dr. Boylston. And the two of them were working to inoculate different residents in Boston. This was happening in sort of an unstructured, unregulated way, and this raised a lot of concerns among the community in Boston. And the way this played out was that several, you know, Cotton Mather and the people who agreed with him would produce a pamphlet, and then the other group of physicians who did not agree with what they were doing would produce a pamphlet, and this sort of went back and forth, and there's several examples of these pamphlets, and, you know, the titles of these pamphlets are very interesting. So the first one, which is there on your right, it says, I don't know if you can read it, but I'll read it to you. It says, some account of what is said of inoculating or transplanting the smallpox in Boston. And then the response to that was the abuses and scandals of some late pamphlets in favor of inoculation of the smallpox modestly obviated and inoculated further inoculation further considered in a letter. And so, and they would go back and forth and address issues that were raised by one of them. So this was sort of a way of having debate that people would have access to, the public would have access to. And, you know, in looking through some of the text of these pamphlets, what they were trying to do was convince the public to sort of agree with them, as often happens with media and press these days. In the 1800s, so this was after the establishment of the Board of Health, what you see here is sort of, again, more printed text that was used to educate the public. The first document sort of on that you see on your right was a discourse delivered in the church of in Brattle Square, Boston, the day appointed for fasting and prayer in Massachusetts on account of the approach of cholera. So again, this is sort of, you know, there's still this idea that your behavior, your sinful behavior or immoral behavior actually is associated with the presence of the disease. We're still seeing this into the 1800s, the middle of the 1800s. But that is actually juxtaposed to this idea that we understand that there's also other factors that are driving the presence of disease. And the city of Boston and the Board of Health at the time actually had the city physician do a report on Asiatic cholera and the question he was trying to answer there was, is it a contagious disease? And so they really were also looking at medical knowledge and current knowledge that we that they had at the time about these diseases. And again, it's an interesting juxtaposition, this idea that, you know, religious beliefs are driving what we knew about disease and how we would prevent disease, as well as at the same time understanding that, you know, that there is a sort of a medical explanation for these things. So just quickly, you know, a summary of the past: town meetings, pamphlets, newspapers, advertisement, and word of mouth. This was the most common way that the public was educated about issues in public health. A lot of times, the information was used to gain support for specific interventions or influence individual behavior for the collective good. And it very much focused on individual behaviors, just in a very narrow sense that it was talking about immoral behaviors being associated with health outcomes. And then the environment, and that environment, again, very much limited to things like sanitation and water. So I'm going to jump to the present now, because I only have 15, 20 minutes for this talk. So now we're in the present. And if we think about the present, and the present includes sort of now, but also thinking about sort of the end of the 20th century, we as the Public Health Commission in Boston have these principles that we use when we're thinking about our public health education. First, we always want to be in a situation where communication with residents, community residents, is bidirectional, in that they're able to, you know, speak with us as we need to speak with them. And there's many structures we sort of have in place to allow that to happen. We always in our education and communication with residents have to consider language and cultural competence. We're a very diverse city. We have residents from, you know, Boston residents from all over the country and large groups of immigrant populations that need to be educated just as everybody else does. And we have been trying and continue to try to make sure that our information reaches all of those who need to be reached. This idea of knowing the audience, I think that this is particularly true if we're talking about data, which I will in a few minutes. This idea that when sharing data with general public or for folks who may not necessarily consume data on a regular basis, it's important to make sure that we're explaining things as clearly as possible. Transparency is very, very important. As a public health agency, we depend on the public's trust. And so in our efforts to educate them, we have to make sure that we're being as transparent as possible and we're sharing with them everything that we know. And it's sort of tied to this dissemination of information in a timely manner. When we had the H1N1 influenza outbreak here in Boston and we had a lot of cases, we were very diligent about sharing information as soon as we learned something or understood something to a point where it could be shared. So in talking about the community education, this idea that right now, a lot of our messaging to the general public focuses on risk reduction and informing residents how to access service. It's very much about the individual. A lot of the education that we do is about individual behaviors that could change, that, you know, changes in individual behavior that would influence your health. And we are trying, and that is very, very valuable, but at this local public health level, we're actually trying and have been trying for several years now to have a greater emphasis on educating community residents about social determinants of health, which is actually a much more, as you know, complicated, it's much more complicated to discuss social determinants of health. It's much easier to talk about sort of, you know, stop smoking or do more exercise, and to help people understand how the context in which they live influences their health is takes ways of methods of educating and communication that are different from our traditional methods that we have used. I think at times we've been asked, you know, why do you think that it's important to educate residents about social determinants of health? And I think that really for us, fundamentally, it's this idea of this is what we understand about factors that are related to health. And if we're not communicating that with the general public, we're not actually being transparent. We're not telling them everything we know, and we're sort of violating some of our basic principles of education and communication with the public. sort of what we share with the public and how we educate the public is often dependent on sort of how we do it. And this is just an example of some of the media messaging we do. Obviously, media, which includes print, electronic, social media, all of those forms of interacting with the public are a great way to sort of share information. However, these media actually can sometimes limit your ability to share things. So a lot of times for us anyway at our level, the media messages we give are very much about individual behaviors. So you see two messages up there about obesity prevention. The first one is directed towards parents. Specifically, it says, you do so much to protect them, but maybe you never realize how much these things could hurt them. And it's talking about the soda bottles that are sitting there on the ground. And the second campaign is actually created by teenagers for teenagers, and it's called Don't Get Smacked by Fat. And actually, if you ever have a chance to go and watch this video, it's actually up on YouTube and on our own website, but it's this slow-motion piece glob of fat coming to hit this person's face as they are drinking soda. So it's this idea that, again, this soda is an unnecessary source of calories. And very much, again, based on focusing on individual behaviors. You know, don't drink soda, don't let your children drink soda. And it's hard to capture messages about social determinants of health in these sort of short bites that the media allows us. So what we've done is we've actually tried to use data, the epidemiologic and surveillance data that we have, to have conversations and educate the general public about social determinants of health. And we do this in a variety of ways. And I'm just going to mention a few. What we do actually is, the first thing we do is we have several community meetings every year in Boston. We work with neighborhood coalitions and neighborhood groups, and we bring to them the data that we have, and we work with them. They will choose sort of what information that they want to present to the residents. And we spend a lot of time reviewing the data and making sure that everybody in the room understands the data. And in the data that we share, we're not just presenting data about sort of the prevalence of this disease or that disease. We are able to actually, with some of our data sources, look at certain socioeconomic stratification. So we look at things by educational attainment and by income and poverty level, and so it gives some people a sense about how these things influence health. The community meetings have actually been very powerful. We have a lot of, you know, the attendance of the community meetings, you know, is variable, but oftentimes we get a lot of people come to the meetings, and they actually really engenders a lot of discussion. You know, people have a lot of questions about, you know, why, you know, education might be associated with health, or why poverty might be associated with health. And a couple of things that do come up. One is that there is some general mistrust of data out there. I think just in the general public, I think people are, you know, there are groups of people who are suspicious of data and the source of data and what we're trying to say with the data. So it's always very interesting to engage in those conversations with the general public and figure out how we can actually relieve some of that mistrust through our presentation of data. Outside of the meetings, we also spend a lot of time generating some reports that, again, do similar things, present descriptive data, stratifications by different determinants of health, and I'm going to show you a few of those. The other thing that's actually sort of a technological advance that has been very helpful to us as we talk about this social determinants of health is GIS and the ability to sort of create interactive maps and let people, it really helps people understand how the place in which they live really can influence their health. This is just something that we use in our community meetings, and I'm not going to actually spend a lot of time on it. I just want to demonstrate how we actually use, we start this our community meetings with this description of what social determinants of health are, and then can lead into data that allows us to look at food access and access to health care, housing, and their relationship with health outcomes. This is just a picture of one of the reports that we produce. I'm going to spend 1 minute on this, is that this is a newspaper. We actually generated a little community newspaper that actually folded out like a real newspaper, and it was called Place Matters. And here we actually were able to spend some time describing in very plain language, again, these concepts of social determinants of health. And we spent, you know, a good 2 or 3 pages on presenting data, again, because it is a very powerful way to communicate about social determinants. And so, you know, as I you know, was looking back in history and in time and looking forward at what we do now, I sort of noticed that there was this, this evolution of community education that has sort of happened and is continuing to happen. In the 17th, 18th, and 19th centuries, we were really focused on environmental factors with some contribution of individual factors that's really limited to these sort of religious beliefs. In the 20th century and present day, we're very, very focused, at least at our local level, on individual factors and a little bit on these environmental factors and talking about environmental factors. And sort of what we're hoping to do in how to sort of move community education forward is really have a discussion that's much broader, that it includes individual factors and social determinants of health and environmental factors, which are part of this concept of social determinants of health. And I think it's not an easy thing to do, and what we've learned is that the data really do help us have this conversation with the general public. This is my last slide. It's just, you know, things that we've been talking about as ways to sort of enhance this ability to communicate with and educate residents about social determinants of health. And easier sharing of data with the general public, supporting data consumption, having a greater role for technology, but still continuing our personal interactions with the general public around this education. That's it. I think I'm over time.
Thank you, Dr. Shaw.